Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Alana Levine.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. He's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known back to the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Little known fact about my guest today. Growing up in Arkansas, he always dreamed of being a storyteller as a way to honor his family and to keep his grandmother's tradition alive. And my goodness, how this playwright and screenwriter and TV writer has done just that. Welcome, Cui Gwin, to the podcast.
A-OK.
Hey, everybody. My guest today is Cui Gwin. Cui is a wildly inventive playwright and screenwriter, and I most recently got to see his incredible play, Poor Yellow Rednecks, at the Manhattan Theater Club. I would describe it as a young Vietnamese family attempts to put down roots in Arkansas. They attempt to balance big hopes with low-wage jobs, and the past is always right along the corner, and it makes for a bumpy road to the American dream. And apparently, unbeknownst to me, it is a companion piece or the next chapter in a story of plays you've written, the first being Viet Gone, which was done how many years ago?
I think I first wrote it in 2014. I think it was produced at MTC in 2016, was when it was produced. And the follow-up, Poor Yellow, was supposed to be in 2020, but then obviously a small thing happened then that forced us to postpone it till now.
Right. A global pandemic. I was actually in a play at MTC when COVID hit. And so to be back in the theater, seeing your play the other day, it's such a special theater. Can you tell us a little bit about your family and how this play came to be?
Yeah. It always goes down to the origins of why I wanted to be a writer in the first place, right? Like I'm the kid of Vietnamese immigrants or refugees specifically. And I wanted my whole life to tell their story because I knew what I was seeing in the world from Miss Saigon's to the war movies of like Platoon and Full Metal Jackets and things like that were happening. And I was like, that's not my family story. That in no way is reflective of the experience of what I've been growing up with. And it's not reflective of the experience of their love story, of what they've gone through. It's always been the perspective of like the white American soldier and never from the actual Vietnamese immigrants themselves. And so I always wanted to tell that story, one, for my own kids and for future generations, but two, just as a way of saying thank you to my parents, because I knew they sacrificed a lot. And they sacrificed one of the most important things was, especially when it came to my grandmother, who didn't speak any English, they had to force themselves to kind of create a language barrier between us. For me to succeed in America, they kind of forced themselves to stop speaking Vietnamese to myself for many years, which kind of dulled out my ability to do that so I could have this anchor of English in this country. And so to take the thing that I'm known for, which is writing, telling stories in English, obviously, and to be able to honor their story, that was such a major important thing for me to do. And then when it comes to the style that I do, that was all developed with the theater company that I started back in like 2003, called Vampire Cowboys. It was this pop culture company that did a lot of quote unquote geek theater, which is just basically a catch-all phrase for doing stuff that had a lot of pop culture, hip hop, and superhero fights and stuff like that. Because I'm also a fight director, so it always gave me a chance to choreograph fights and puppetry and stuff like that into my shows. It was also a chance to kind of create superheroes for at that time. There was like before, you know, Marvel Studios, a chance to create superheroes for those who don't, for all of us who don't often get to see ourselves that way. At that time, women, LGBTQ, queer folks, people of color. And so it was a chance to be able to create heroes that way. And then when I sat down to finally write these plays, I was like, I'm going to take that style because that's who I am and tell my parents' story in that style. So that's kind of the combo shot of what made Poor Yellow Rednecks, Poor Yellow Rednecks.
Okay, so I'm sitting in Poor Yellow Rednecks. I'm thinking of August Wilson and different writers over the years who have kind of created this legacy of following families or people like through the decades, right? And I think about, you know, Arthur Miller did it, you're doing it, sort of taking us into the world of these familiar characters and kind of letting us check in with them along the way. But what is so extraordinary to me, and, you know, in knowing that the play is so autobiographical, to understand that your parents in 1975 find themselves both with past and, in your father's case, a previous family, and your mom and grandma are all arriving and are in basically a refugee camp in Arkansas, which I cannot imagine. Haven't spent a lot of time in Vietnam or Arkansas, but my gut tells me they're very different on every single level. And yeah, there's this thing in the play where in order for you to assimilate, as it were, there's this incredible connection between you and your grandmother that somehow gets torn apart because of this language thing. But now I'm like talking to a man who writes for Disney and Marvel, started at an English-speaking theater company, has plays done at all of the best theaters around the world. So tell me about this love of writing and when, obviously, your proficiency in English you know, is unbelievable. And you know, you are a Shakespeare for our time. So how did it go from a household of just Vietnamese, a school in Arkansas of just English? When did the dots connect, and when did writing become your passion?
I always go, it's more storytelling than writing than anything else. And it always comes from my grandmother, right? Mm-hmm. Like the fact that she, because I know the origin story of it all. It was, I remember my grandmother would talk to me constantly. I was like her little man. There was like my mom and dad, because they were blue collar, they woke up early in the morning and stayed at their jobs late at night. So I didn't see them as much because they needed to put, you know, food on the table. And so my grandmother became like the anchor of who I saw every day. And she would just tell me stories constantly. I remember there was a thing that I said to her. I was like, why knowing you are, which is basically grandma, why are you talking so much? Why are you constantly telling me stuff? And I remember my grandmother very specifically said, because I have nothing. I when we escaped Vietnam, I wasn't able to bring photo albums or jewelry or money or any of those things. So the only thing I have of value are my stories. That's it. That is the only thing I have to give you. And honestly, I think it's probably the most important thing to give you, because it's kind of the only thing we get to carry in our hearts. It's the only thing that we get to hold on to our last dying days. And the moment we start to lose them, like if you're going through dementia or Alzheimer's, those are things that we hold most precious, right? And having that idea, that thing that my grandmother told me at such an early age, became the thing that was stuck in my head since like the age of five, all the way up to how old I am now. That I was like, oh, the most valuable thing that any of us have is the stories that we carry, the things that we experience, things that we share with, you know, some stories we only share with our lover, some that we just share with our kids, with our family. For me, it's obviously sharing with the world. And then there's some that you just hold on preciously to yourself that you don't share with anyone. And those just that became so important to me. And that became my obsession, to be a storyteller. And obviously, because English became such a point of contention, not between my parents about how I was going to tackle it, but then also a point of like focus, because they're like, because it wasn't just that I had to be good at English. I had to become the English translator for my mom, my dad, my grandmother. I filled out every form I wrote. And this is a common story with a lot of kids that have immigrant parents. I became that English linchpin for them. And so that's why, like, both the, you know, my wordsmithing and the stories that I tell became so integral and so important to me that when I kind of grew up and dreamt of what I wanted to be, that dream of an 8-year-old kid, it was to go, oh, I want to tell my parents' story. I want to tell superhero stories. I wanted to tell super heroic stories about my parents. So generations later of kids that look like me and my children will always have heroes that look like them.
Well, what a profound thing it must be then to have a dream or fantasy about what you want to do, and you're doing it on like this really huge stage, both film, television, and theater. So what was your way in professionally? You know, as I mentioned, you work at Disney and Marvel, and you know, you're such a prolific person in all of these lanes. How did it go from a kid like who loved superheroes, and I assume watching movies growing up, to like, this is what you do as a grown person?
I mean, I'm very DIY, if I'm going to be honest. Like, I think that, because I mean, if you look at my resume, if you looked at who I was at 25, I don't think I was the perfect candidate to have the career that I currently have, right? Like, I'm a kid of immigrants. I did not grow up with a lot of money. I graduated from not very, you know, famous schools for writers, including like my graduate school. I have a degree in playwriting at a school now that doesn't offer a degree in playwriting anymore because they can't keep enough writers there. So when I got to New York, I don't think there was a lot of people knocking on my door to find out what they needed from me. And so that's why I started my theater company, Vampire Cowboys. I needed to create my own opportunities. Those opportunities were kind of like elevated by my now wife, but then just person I met, I will say, who had seen my shows and was like, you're a really good artist, but you're a terrible producer. But I am a producer. Her name's Abby Marcus. And she took over my company and found a way to get the attention it deserved. She took my geek theater style and was like, you know what? We can't compete with those that want to go to Lincoln Center. So instead, we're going to go find your audience at New York Comic Con. So she, with her own money, got a booth at New York Comic Con and then started asking me to stage fights at New York Comic Con to get attention. And then all those fans at New York Comic Con became the core fans of my work and my company. And we kind of sold out every performance of every show for a decade straight. And then from that, I got my first managers and agents and the curiosity of the bigger theaters. And then the truth is, even though I got that attention, I was financially still pretty poor. I was very popular, but also very poor. And so when I wrote Vit Gone, the intent for Vit Gone at that time was for it to be my last play. I was going to give up. I thought this was it. I had gone as far as this life could go as a writer. I mean, and I'm just going to go do something else because I have kids. I have a marriage that I need to work on. This was going to be it. And what a great way to close it out. It's a story about my family, which I've always wanted to tell, with the set of artists that I had grown up with me the last 20 years. Maureen Sebastian, who's the lead in Poor Yellow Rednecks, was someone I met back in 2006. I've written so many plays for her. I was like, you know what? And Paco Tolson and John Hoche as well. I get to do this with, you know, a story about my family with my chosen family. What a great way to end it. And then, of course, you know, obviously my career has changed quite a bit since 8 years ago. Basically, this group of actors wouldn't give up on me. They transformed my life through this play. They didn't give up on me, even though I had given up on myself. And they kind of forced my hand into creating myself a career. And then, you know, obviously, you know, people that are much fancier than myself took attention and gave me opportunities to, you know, write in television and film and kind of really actually live out those dreams I had as 8-year-old kid. And I still pinch myself to this day that I've gotten to make Ryan the Last Dragon, that I got to make Strange World, that I get to make Vit Gone and She Calls Monsters and now Poor Yellow Rednecks. Like, these are things that I never thought I would be able to do, especially when I was about to give up on it in, you know, 2014.
That is unbelievable. I have a sort of just a random question, but growing up in, did you call it Arkansas or Arkansas when you were growing up?
Arkansas.
Okay. So growing up in Arkansas, what did Bill Clinton mean to you? And what did it mean when he became president?
Well, he means a lot to me, like extremely personally, because he was an integral person in bringing my my middle brother to America. And when I say my middle brother, I mean, he's actually literally my cousin. And, you know, his story to getting to America was he was a Vietnamese boat person. The boat that he tried to escape on or was escaping on, the engine died halfway through their journey. And he unfortunately lost both his parents and his older brother. And he was then discovered by Filipino fishermen. And he ended up at a refugee camp in the Philippines. And at that time in 1988, the average time it took to get someone over that wasn't your direct relative, meaning your parent or your kid, was about 2 years, if not 4 years, was more average. And my mom refused to accept that as, you know, the circumstance. Like, I'm not going to let my nephew stay in a refugee camp without a family for that many years. And so she went to the governor's mansion in Little Rock, and the governor at the time in 1988 was Bill Clinton. And so she made a lot of noise, and, you know, Bill, you know, it being a nice election year for him, but I'm not going to say that's why he did it, but like, I'm going to say like what he was an integral part in expediting my cousin coming to America. Like, the thing that was supposed to take years ended up taking like 4 months, and it became like the feel good story of my home state. And that's kind of like the subject matter of VidCon 3, the play that comes after Poor Yellow Rednecks that I'm currently writing. And it is about that single thing, that kind of superheroic move of my mom doing that, and also the journey of my cousin getting to America. But Bill Clinton obviously is a major component to all that, because without him, we would never have been able to expedite that. So Bill Clinton does actually weirdly mean a lot to me and my family.
Wow, that's incredible. So how do you get to New York as a kid growing up where you grew up? Did you ever come like on a class trip to New York growing up? What was your introduction to New York City?
No, I had never been to New York City. It was in grad school, my final year in grad school. My friends and I, everyone was like, going for internships, because that was part of our graduate to graduate, you had to do an internship. And I chose New York City. And then I just kind of fell in love with the city. I was like, well, I mean, the truth is, when I was a kid, those were the two places I've always wanted to live. I always wanted to live in New York and LA. I always wanted to do, theater, and I always wanted to make movies. And so New York became the choice because my friends and I had gone there on internship.
And literally when you get here, did you have relatives here? Did you have like a number of a friend of a friend? Like, how do you, did you fly into JFK? And then like, what happened?
Yeah, I graduated. I literally like the day after I graduated from Ohio University, I hopped a ride with a friend of mine. She drove me to New York. I subletted a room from a couple that I had found out about from my internship. The people who worked in the office, like, hey, there's a room available. And so that's how I ended up there for about 2 months. And then randomly, while I was walking around Chinatown, I bumped into an undergrad friend of mine who was on tour, and he was completing his tour. He was doing a children's theater tour. He's like, oh, I want to move here to New York. I need a roommate. I was like, I'll be your roommate. And it was just the most random thing that ever happened. And so then we just got a place in Williamsburg. And then that's where I lived for like 15 years.
And started this theater company sort of grassroots and found people, including a wife. So before we started recording, you were describing why you are at this moment not in New York or LA, but in Cincinnati, Ohio, because your wife runs
Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. So like, as my great giant dream was to make movies and to do to do theater, her dream was only to do theater, and her big dream was to run a major regional theater. And so when we were in LA, she got headhunted for this job. And so I was like, I don't know what kind of husband I'd be if I wasn't like, this is your big dream. Why would I stop you from doing this? We'll make it work. Like, it's unfair for me to get my dreams and you not to get yours. And so so we live in two different cities and we're making it work. You know, she's in Cincinnati, I'm in Los Angeles. I fly a lot to be able to be there for I see them all the time. But obviously it's been good on my frequent flyer miles. Uh, but physically, I might be a little more physically beat up than I was, say, 2 years ago.
So it's happened. I assume at some point your parents and kids, have they been in an audience at the same time with you seeing the play?
My parents have never seen the play. The first play, mainly because when I interviewed them for the stories that they were giving, they didn't know I was writing a play about them. They thought I was just trying to get context for the Vietnamese American experience, not realizing that I was literally going to tell a story about them. And so once they started seeing all the reviews and it was being written like Vietnamese papers and things like that, they realized it was literally about them. And they're like, you know, we haven't really dealt emotionally with this stuff. Like when we talked to and told you all these stories, it was kind of like the first time we've told them in years.
Oh my God.
Quite ready to deal with that stuff. And now they're just at a point in their lives where they don't travel as well. And so so they haven't had a chance to see them. So my little brother and I this past year actually shot a documentary on it was called The Family Viet Gone. And it's about the plays themselves, but it's also interviews with my mom and dad and my brother. And we're bringing that to them because it's something that I can just travel to Arkansas where they're still at, you know, rent a theater and let them get some kind of context of how the world sees them. Like that right now, it's been produced all over the place, Viet Gone. So many people know their stories. There's literally fans of my parents. And it's like, it's so weird because they have no context of what that feels like or what that, you know, how many people know them. And so making that documentary, and it's literally a documentary for an audience of seven, my two parents, my two kids, and my three nieces, that's it. And to be able to give it to them has been really wonderful. And my kids, of course, seen all my plays and they love my plays because one, they get to sit in a room where they get to see adults swear a lot. And they're like, hee hee, they're cussing and they won't let me cuss.
How old are your kids?
Well, now they're my oldest is 14 and my youngest is 10, but they were obviously much younger when Viet Gone was rolling.
Yes, they were little.
But they enjoy it because, you know, my stuff is so colorful. It's so fun. It's so funny. Like it's more comedy than anything else. And so they enjoy all the superheroic stuff that exists in the plays. And then they get some real like context about their family, you know?
Yeah, it's incredible. So you're raising mixed race kids in Ohio. And do you feel like when you look at that, sort of how you grew up and how your kids are growing up, do you have anything that comes to mind about that experience?
Well, I mean, it's definitely like the thing that like, that, you know, my wife and I talk about often, you know, like the fact that they are, you know, Vietnamese or Vietnamese American and Jewish. And I think that there was a thing that I remember them saying, I remember responding, you're not half Asian, you're not half Jewish, you are Asian and you are Jewish. You are not half of anything, you are whole these things. You just happen to be genetically, you're both your mom and dad, but you are whole these things. And that's a context I didn't have before I had kids. You know, before I had kids, I didn't think about that at all. And now to have them, I go, oh. And so I think both my wife and I take it very, you know, we understand the importance to make sure that they're exposed and they feel, you know, proud of both those elements of who they are, you know.
Well, this is a play that is based in pride. I mean, Poor Yellow Rednecks is, if nothing else, it is about just embracing and loving and honoring. It is such a like absolute delight. It's a delight and it's moving and it's funny. And I just can't even imagine what it is to watch it, to be the person who lived this story and see all that love expressed on stage. It's really one of the most extraordinary plays I've ever seen. And every actor in your play and your brilliant director and your designers and everything about it is just really, a lasting experience for me as a viewer and of someone who felt really privileged to get to see it. So congratulations. Can you just say, you mentioned you're working on another play. So is it a trilogy in your mind or is there no end in sight of where can go?
It originally was supposed to be five plays. The whole sequence, but now I've broken it up. So there's the trilogy of plays, which Is Vit Gone, Poor Yellow Rednecks, and this third play that I'm doing. And then there's...
Wait, what are you saying? I'm sorry, because we're on Zoom. What is the name of this third piece?
It doesn't have a name yet.
Oh.
Yeah. It's that one's commissioned by the Geffen in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Here in New York. And so like that's the play that I'm currently writing. And then there's two more plays in that kind of series of Vit Gone world that I've kind of separated that outside of it. It used to be one solid five play story. And now it's this trilogy of my family's origin story and these two more plays that are about kind of my grandmother's upbringing in Vietnam and, you know, and then also my parents in their elderly years. And yeah. So those are kind of like the kind of five stories that I'm telling.
Okay. My last, I have one more question. Have you been to Vietnam?
I have not been to Vietnam. We were going to go in 2020. We had a trip with my mom to go, and then obviously it got canceled for the global pandemic. And so we are now planning it again. We are in the process of planning that trip finally again. So yeah, we're excited. We're excited.
I am unbelievably grateful to have this time with you. Congrats on the play. Congrats on your beautiful family. Congrats on finding a way to honor your parents that is so universal in its dramatic telling, that whether your family is from Vietnam or wherever they are from, if you are a human being, you will connect to Quee's writing. So congratulations. Thank you for spending this time with me today. I'm so honored.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I feel honored for just being on the show. So thank you so much.
Well, until next time, I can't wait to see the next play and I wish you a wonderful day.
Oh, thank you too.
Bye. Bye.
Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that now you know.
I have some news. Little Known Facts is now available to watch on YouTube. Hours and hours and hours of interviews that you can see my fabulous guests. And guess what? It's called Little Known Facts with Alana Levine. Catchy, right? Anyway, head on over to YouTube and watch the podcast. And please don't forget to subscribe. Also, if you want to donate to the podcast, zero pressure. But if you want to, no donation is too big or too small. I am so grateful for you for listening. But if you want to donate, just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. Lastly, Little Known Facts is recorded in Brooklyn, New York, USA. My editor is Nicholas Klar. None of this happens without Nicholas. And the Little Known Facts theme song was composed and sung by Georgia Famusa with backup vocals by Caleb Famusa. Thank you for listening and have an amazing day.